The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's a Laugh. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. We start today's show with a quote found on hookedtobooks.com. From Lemony Snicket, "When trouble strikes, head to the library. You will either be able to solve the problem or simply have something to read as the world crashes down on you." Here on TAL, we like a good book, and we really like a good book introduction. Today, we have not just one, but two great introductions. Sometimes in our lives, we don't get things quite right. Sometimes we continue to not get things right. Today's excerpts help us remember that it's never too late to try and get it right, whatever right looks like for each of us. First, we will hear from R. Eric Thomas. From his book, Here For It, or How to Save Your Soul in America, Essays, published in 2020, Introduction, The Monster at the End of This Book. For a number of years, I was under the impression that my birth was the result of an immaculate conception. Not the immaculate conception, a regular immaculate conception, of an ordinary variety. I didn't think I was particularly special, or meant to die so that the world might be saved from their sins. I struggled to get through a CrossFit class, so actual crucifixion might be a bit of a heavy lift. I understood that some people got pregnant to have babies. I simply thought I'd been opted out of that particular program. It made just as much sense to me that the universe had given a baby to my parents because they were nice people who photographed well. When my mother would tell me about life before me, she would always say the same thing. "We wanted a child so badly. My arms used to ache for the weight of a baby. We prayed and we prayed and we prayed, and finally, God gave you to us." How would you interpret that story? Immaculately, that's how. I thought some people just got babies handed to them, like party favors at a quinceañera, by a creator-type figure. Bob and Judy asked very nicely, "Cue my entrance, avec jazz hands." This all checks out, at least as much as the other Immaculate Conception, a.k.a. the birth of Jesus. On that, I was an expert, having gotten straight A's in Sunday school for years. There were no grades, but I scored myself. Plus, I was a very good child. Obedient, pleasant, an avid reader, an unrepentant snitch. So, of course, I knew the story backwards and forwards. The angel and the three kings and the sheep and Mariah Carey singing "All I Want for Christmas Is You," etc. My own sudden appearance on the scene, regular yet also extraordinary, sans animals, no royalty as RSVPs, was totally within my conceptual wheelhouse. What I couldn't figure out, however, was why. As a child, I liked certainty and order and clear explanations, even if they tended to involve miracles. But life, of course, can quickly get complicated and human and not at all miraculous. I'd sometimes find myself so lost in a question or problem that the only solution I could think of was for an older version of myself to walk through a rift in the space-time continuum and let me know what happens. Immaculately. As my concept of self expanded and evolved beyond my extraordinary beginnings, different parts of who I was began to prompt queries that I thought only the future could answer. I had this idea that the challenges I suddenly encountered, my blackness, or my gayness, or my Christianness, or my Americanness, and their intersections, would somehow get uncomplicated through the magic of time, like a movie montage. Spoiler alert, they did not. But I would think about the supposed perfection of the future constantly. I'd be sitting in my childhood bedroom, or my college dorm, or my first apartment, just staring at the door like, any minute now in the future, they're going to invent time travel, and some well-dressed old black man with no wrinkles is going to come bursting through and give me the answers to this take-home quiz, or whatever. Sometimes my questions were existential. Sometimes they were AP statistical. The basic concern was always the same. Am I really here for this? The big idea, as I saw it, was this. You don't exist for a long time. Before you arrive, there are ages, eons, an eternity without you. Can you imagine? How boring. And suddenly, there you are. Alive. How you doing? How's it feel? Immaculate. What if it feels bad? Don't worry, it gets better, right? What if it doesn't get better? It just gets. It just keeps getting. What then? You still interested? You still trying to be good? Still moisturizing your T-zone? Still working through your stack of New Yorkers? Still fighting systemic oppression? Still speaking truth to power? Still attempting to exist? Still? What if I told you, at another point, fixed supposedly, but totally unknown, you suddenly, mysteriously, immaculately won't be anymore? Again. Does that sound like something you want to do? I'm a spoiler queen. My favorite part of reading mystery novels is flipping ahead to the last chapter. Of course, at that point, I'm always like, who are all of these people? How did this happen? When did they go to Nova Scotia? So I have to go back and reread and find out. Ugh, it's a whole process. My relationship with mystery is fraught. It was the same with Choose Your Own Adventures. I certainly wasn't about to go flipping through a book willy-nilly, letting fate take me on a ride like Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I always turned to an option, read it, kept my finger in it, then flipped back and read the other option, like a normal American. Some books try to get slick and give you 4 or 5 choices. The joke was on them, though. I had 5 fingers. 10, actually, now that I think about it. This book is not a choose-your-own-adventure, much as I would have liked the option in real life. It's the opposite of that, actually, if such a thing is possible. It might be a mystery, though. At the end, I gather all the suspects in a room, and there are some very bold accusations made. It involves a luxury ocean liner. There's a caftan. Things escalate. More than anything, this book is a version of the book where I, as a child, found all my answers and all my questions. You guessed it, the most sacred of tomes, the monster at the end of this book, starring Grover, the Muppet, not the U.S. president. Lovable, furry old Grover, blue, fuchsia nose, scatterbrained, sometimes super. Here's the plot. Grover shows up, reads the title, realizes there's a monster at the end of the book, and then asks you, the reader, not to continue reading so as not to bring him face to face with the thing he fears, with the thing that he fears. Listen, I have an idea, he says to us on page 2, breaking the fourth wall like he's in a midnight screening of Rocky Horror. If you do not turn any pages, we will never get to the end of this book. And that is good, because there is a monster at the end of this book. So please do not turn the page. Flip. You turned the page, he screams. So much is already happening. Grover's horror escalates with every page turn, eventually getting to the point where he is futilely building a wall, putting up caution tape, pleading with you. Pitilessly, you persist. By the end of the book, Grover is in full hysterics. But then we turn the last page, and Grover realizes that the monster at the end of the book is himself. Stunning! He is the Kaiser Soze of Muppets, and that's the book. This book is meta as hell. It's like Borges for toddlers. Who does this? Also, this book is terrifying. It's psychological torture. Gone Girl for Muppets. When I read it as a child, I didn't want to turn the page. I didn't want to torture Grover. I wonder if there's ever been a child who, when asked not to continue, simply closed the book and went on with their life. I want to know that obedient child. But the book's success is predicated on the assumption that we will not heed his simple request. That is terrible. And I think that's why I like this book so much. I am Grover. I walk with him every step of the way on his journey. The monster at the end of this book is a light-hearted book about anxiety. Anxiety about being confronted with the kind of person you really are. LOL! Anxiety about the inevitable passage of time. LOL! Anxiety about being trapped by forces beyond your control. LOL! Anxiety about a deep, dreadful uncertainty. Meep! Even when I read it for the first time at age 3, I got that. I was an anxious, though immaculately conceived, child, and an anxious, square, pious preteen, and an anxious, half-zealot / half-gay teen, and an anxious, aimless young adult careening toward this moment. I am anxious right now, actually, come to think of it. I'll definitely be an anxious dad. I'm sure I'll be an anxious old man, and I'll probably end up lying in my grave going, "Ugh, I feel like there's something I should be doing right now. I wonder if everyone is angry at me. Oh my God, how long is this going to take? And what happens next?" Grover, too, is struggling. He is using every tool at his disposal to keep the thing that he fears the most at bay, and that thing is himself. He is almost crippled by his own fear, but he is still trying. Grover is the Willy Loman of Sesame Street. On the internet, I play more of an Elmo than a Grover. I write funny columns, mostly visible for Elle.com. I make jokes about the news on Twitter. Sometimes I write plays about social justice that have the audacity to end happily. I try to shake what's dark about the world and I try to take what's dark about the world and shake out the satirical and the silly. Everybody loves Elmo, right? Elmo is a closer. Elmo gets all the Glengarry leads. Elmo stares into the abyss and the abyss whispers, "Tickle me." But in real life, I'm a Grover. I have always been black in a white environment. Not black enough in a black environment, working class in an upper class environment, Christian in a secular environment, questioning in a devout environment, gay in a straight environment, never quite right. I grew up a little ball of potential, but oblivious, gay energy in a Baptist family from a black Baltimore neighborhood where there were more abandoned houses than lived-in ones. My parents sent me to school in a rich suburb where most of my classmates were white. Every moment from then on, I was an other. The thing is, I felt it, but I didn't realize it. Other felt like a funhouse narrative. It felt like doing something wrong, or worse, being something wrong. So I ignored it for as long as I could, creating certainty where I could. And when that didn't work, I anxiously awaited a spoiler to burst through time and let me know if this whole thing was going to end badly. That for a while seemed like life. And if I was really being honest with myself, I wasn't into it. The only option was to sit in the pews every Sunday at church and casually wonder if I was going to go to hell because of who I was. No, thank you. or to understand that the structures on which the country was built were engineered against me? Hard pass. What choice did I have besides constantly code-switching between identities as a means of hiding in plain sight? And wasn't it just normal to feel like such a mistake as an adult that every time I walked over a bridge or stood on a subway platform, I had to talk myself out of stepping over the edge? I came to believe I was a monster and that I deserved to feel that the way that I felt, and I didn't want to turn the page. But through it all, there was a constant tethering me to the idea of a future. The library. The library is the place where I could borrow first Grover's philosophical tome, then a couple of choose-your-own-adventures I could cheat at, and later a stack of mysteries I could spoil for myself, all attempts to look for some other way of understanding who I was. In the stack of books, I found The Bluest Eye, The Color Purple, and Giovanni's Room, and David Rakoff's Fraud, and more. I saw a new vision of otherness in those books, and the pages kept turning. At the end of every one was a wall waiting to be broken down, a lurch toward becoming, a new paragraph in a story with an ending far different from what I'd ever dared imagine. Every story, whether truth or fiction, is an invitation to imagination, but even more so, it's an invitation to empathy. The storyteller says, "I am here. Does it matter?" The words that I found in these books were a person calling out from a page, "I am worthy of being heard, and you are worthy of hearing my story." It seems simple, but it's a bold declaration. How many times in life do we receive the message, implicit or explicit, that what we've experienced or what we feel isn't noteworthy or remarkable? The books that I found in the library, ones that I deeply understood, and ones that seemed so outside of my experience they might as well have been written in Klingon, all carried the same hopes: to be seen, to be heard, to exist. Hope is tricky, however, when what's waiting at the conclusion is monstrous, literally or figuratively. You can declare your own worthiness to the world, but that doesn't always mean you believe it yourself. There's a Nayira Wahid quote, "If someone does not want me, it is not the end of the world. But if I do not want me, the world is nothing but endings." That is the problem that troubles this book. "Listen, I have an idea," Grover says. "If you do not turn any pages, we will never get to the end of this book." And yet, I'm a spoiler queen. I'll see you at the end. And our next introduction, from Girl Stop Apologizing, A Shame-Free Plan for Embracing and Achieving Your Goals, written by Rachel Hollis and published in 2019. Introduction, What If? When I originally started writing this book, I fully planned on calling it Sorry, Not Sorry. And yes, I was basing that title on a Demi Lovato song. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that the song was the impetus for this entire book. Imagine, if you will, the late summer of 2017 when I first heard this jam. It was a sunny Monday morning. I know it was Monday morning because my entire staff was dancing around our conference table, pumping ourselves up for our weekly kickoff meeting. And I know it was sunny because it was summertime in Los Angeles. The exorbitant property taxes ensure that the climate will never fall below a balmy 73 degrees. We always dance to it. We always dance it out before big meetings because it brings up our energy and gets us in the right headspace. Each week, to keep things fair, we rotate the role of house DJ, the person on our team who gets to pick our pump-up music. That summer, the entire staff, besides me, was under 28, so it was a millennial box of chocolates. You never knew what you were going to get. On that particular Monday, I heard the song for the first time. It was Love at First Listen. If you've never rocked out to this particular piece, you should add it to your workout playlist immediately. It's upbeat and fun and irreverent to the point of challenge. The exact kind of inspiration you want before an intense cardio session or a first run in the local mayoral election. Demi lets us know that she's looking great and feeling great and living life on her own terms, and she's sorry, but she's not sorry. I live for this kind of jam. It's poppy and catchy and easily fits in the arsenal of music I use to give myself energy or alter my mood. After that first experience, I quickly developed a song crush. I listened to it in the shower, in the gym, in the car. I even went so far as to play the Kidz Bop version when my children were around so I could keep it in rotation. I mean, that's commitment, you guys. Anyone who has ever suffered through Kidz Bop can attest that it's the seventh circle of parenting hell, and that's how much I love this song. I listened to it all the time, and eventually a question popped into my head. What am I not sorry about? See, Demi, she's not sorry about living life on her terms. She's not sorry for looking good or feeling good or making her ex-boyfriend jealous or taking a bubble bath in a jacuzzi in the living room, if her music video is anything to go by. But what about me? What were the areas in my life that I absolutely refused to apologize for? I wish I could tell you that every part of my life is a long list of not giving a tinker's damn what anyone else thinks, but that wouldn't be truthful no matter how much I want to set an example for you now. As a side note, I spent much of my last Christmas holiday in bed sick with a horrible chest cold. I used that time to read many historical romance novels set in the Regency era with brooding dukes who were always saying things like, "Evangeline, I don't give a tinker's damn what society thinks," just before kissing the heroine with the passion of 10,000 suns or whatever. My New Year's resolution was to start using the term tinker's damn in everyday speech. I've already accomplished my dreams, and it's only January 2nd. Huzzah! But truly, like many other women, I'm still in the process of overcoming a lifetime of people-pleasing. I constantly strive to move through every part of my life unconcerned with the opinion of others, but truthfully, I don't always achieve it. Yes, even me, the professional advice giver, even I sometimes get trapped inside the crippling weight of other people's expectations and have to talk myself down from the ledge. Embracing the idea that you can want things for yourself, even if nobody else understands the whys behind them, is the most freeing and powerful feeling in the world. You want to be a third-grade teacher? Wonderful. Open a dog grooming studio where you specialize in dyeing poodles pink? Great. You want to save up to go on a lavish vacation where you ask everyone to refer to you as Bianca when your actual name is Pam? Fantastic. Whatever the dream, it's yours, not mine. You don't have to give any justification, because as long as you're not asking anyone to give you approval, then you don't need anyone to give you permission. In fact, when you understand that you don't have to justify your dreams to anyone else for any reason, that's the day you truly begin to step into who you're meant to be. I don't mean that you go around middle fingers up like a Beyoncé song. I don't mean that you turn bitter and rude and shove your goals into other people's faces to prove a point. I mean that you focus in on the dream you have. You do the work, you put in the hours, and you stop feeling guilty about it. A dream starts with a question, and the question is always some form of, what if? What if I went back to school? What if I tried to build that? What if I pushed myself to run 26.2 miles? What if I moved to a new city? What if I'm the one who could change the system? What if God put this in my heart for a reason? What if I could add some income to our bank account? What if I could write a book that would help people? That what if, that's your potential knocking on the door of your heart and begging it to find the courage to override all the fear in your head. That what if is there for a reason. That what if is your guidepost. That what if tells you where to focus next. If every woman who heard that what if in her heart allowed it to feed the flame in her belly to pursue who she might be, not only would she shock herself with what she's capable of, but she'd astound everyone else as well. I'm convinced that if we, just lived life in pursuit of answering that question, the effect on the world around us would be atomic. Can you imagine if 25% more of the world, or 15% more, or even just 5% more women decided to embrace their what if? Can you imagine if they stopped allowing the guilt or shame that comes from not being a certain way or a certain type of woman to quash their potential? I spent a lot of time trying to figure out exactly how I wanted to lay out this book. It's the most, I hope anyway, tactical advice I've ever written down. I wanted it to be easy to understand and easy to apply to any kind of goal. And so I needed to get to the core of what has made it possible for me to achieve my dreams. What I finally asked myself was, which elements have either helped or hurt me in my pursuit of personal goals over the last 15 years? I am not an expert. What I am is your friend Rachel, and I want to tell you what worked for me. I have tried a bit of everything, but ultimately, achieving big goals both personally and professionally came down to these three things. 1. Letting go of the excuses that kept me stuck. 2. Adopting great habits and behaviors that set me up for success. 3. Acquiring the skills necessary to make exponential growth possible. This book has a lot of information. It took me a lifetime to acquire it, but please don't allow that to overwhelm you. You are strong and bold and capable of more. From here on out, choose to see ideas for change as possibilities in your life. A life filled with possibilities is a recipe for your kind of greatness. Let's dive in. And we've run out of time for today's episode of That's a Laugh. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. That's a Laugh is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number, one more time, is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.